Okay. Anyways, so for percolation, which was this geometric problem that I mentioned is just a counterpoint, direct counterpoint to a spin system, we have three different regimes of behavior. We have P less than PP, less than PC, the critical point, and here we have just finite clusters. In a spin system, which is perhaps the thing which you're more familiar with in terms of like where the renormalization group is applied, for a spin system, the natural parameter is the temperature. Actually, the natural parameter is not the temperature itself, but the ratio of the coupling strength divided by the temperature. But let's say we're talking about the temperature, and the analog of P less than PC is T larger than TC. And so when T is larger than TC, one has disorder when you're way above the critical temperature. But as you approach a critical temperature, you'll develop small little regions of order in a sea of disorder. So here, the way we should think about this, the analog of finite clusters is islands, maybe small islands of order in a sea of disorder. If any of you know who Leonard Cohen is, this could be a title of a Leonard Cohen song. P greater than PC. So here we have an infinite cluster, and the remaining clusters that remain, by definition, are just finite. So there's an infinite cluster and complementary finite clusters. And the complementary finite clusters are the thing that we're going to end up focusing on. This is a Y. And here, in the case of a spin system, we have T less than TC. And here what we have is small islands of, say, down spins in a sea of up. And finally, at the critical point, P equals PC, there is scale invariance. And this is manifested by the fact there's clusters of all sizes. And in fact, a power law distribution of cluster sizes. And similarly here, at T equals TC, again, there is scale invariance. And the same thing, clusters of all sizes. In fact, this distribution of clusters, so let me just say power law distribution, power law size distribution. Because in order to have no scale, you can't have any kind of exponential cutoff. And the natural way to have no scale at all is to have a power law distribution of clusters. And similarly here, power law.
So can you say what you said again about the power law?
Okay, so the point is that if I were to actually calculate, if I were to like simulate percolation at the critical point, and look at the cluster size distribution, and then look at what it is. It'll have a power law tail.
The reason?
Pardon me?
The reason why it's not anything else?
Well, because the point is that a power law is something that has no natural scale in it. Like typically, you know, if you say you have exponential decay, e to the minus x over, there's going to be x over some natural scale. So typically, functions that decay faster than a power law necessarily have a natural scale built into them, and power laws do not. You know, so if I say like if this here is like you know s to the minus 2, there's no natural scale here. There's no characteristic size. There's just all sizes represented.
What about sines and cosines, stuff like
Say
that?
it again?
Sines and cosines?
Well, but that, I mean, first of all, it goes negative, so you don't want a distribution that's negative. So you want something that's manifestly positive. Pardon me? Yeah, but that's got like a characteristic scale, which is the wavelength of the sine or the cosine. So anything that you're going to think of that you can come up with will have a natural scale built in. except for power law. Whoa.
So what?
Okay. So next point, and this is a part that I kind of like lost, did not really state very clearly last time, is now let's look at rescaling, or maybe I'll put here spatial rescaling. Rescaling. So what happens if we take either a percolation system or a spin system, and we do what I did last time in my lecture, which was that I would, you know, squish down, I would change my magnification and keep doing it over and over again. And the question is, what happens when you do the spatial rescaling? And again, we have the same kind of parallelism between percolation and a spin system. And part of the reason I'm going to focus on percolation is the fact that it's just much easier mathematically to analyze. So in percolation, if I start at some value of p, which is less than pc, then we argued, and I tried to show in a picture, well, actually I only did it for p larger than pc, but it's sort of obvious that if I start at p less than pc and I have small finite clusters and I rescale, these clusters are just going to get smaller and smaller every time I rescale, and so this will eventually end up at p equals 0. If I start at p bigger than pc, I'll end up at p equals 1, which is what I showed in my animation last time. And it's only at PC that I just stay at PC invariant. And the analog in the spin system is that I start at T larger than TC. So I have little islands of order in a sea of disorder. And as I rescale, then these islands will get smaller and smaller and disappear. And then I'll just have the sea of disorder, which corresponds to I'm going to t going to infinity. If I start at t less than tc, then I'll have little islands of downspins in a sea of up, for example, or vice versa. And as I rescale, these little islands, mismatched islands, will disappear, and then I'll just have perfect magnetization. So I'm going to the t equals 0 limit. And finally, at tc, that is invariant. So that's kind of the or parallelism between a percolation and a spin system. And now what I want to do is so now let's look at a rescaling factor. Let's look at the behavior of the system under rescaling. And so so suppose suppose there's a rescale factor.
Wait, sorry, I've got a question. Is this spatial rescaling? Are you talking about like yesterday, how you showed on the screen? Are you kind of zoomed out?
And squished in. I mean, so I imagine that I take a 100 by 100 system, and I say I'm going to make it an effective 50 by 50 mm-hmm. system, and then I have to ask, like, in this effective 50 by 50 system, how do I replace the degrees of freedom? So as I squish, you know, like I'll have, say, a little cell of 8 bonds, and I've got to make it into a little cell of 4 bonds. Like, how do I define the rescaled value of P? And that's basically the whole goal of the renormalization group, is to figure out what is the rescaling of the basic parameters.
How come we only look at spatial rescaling as that squishing in rather than as like zooming in on like...
Why do I do that? But no, but you're free to do it the other way around. But I mean, it's useful only if you're doing like the rescaling by a smaller and smaller thing. Because the point is that at the critical point, the crucial thing are the fact that there's infinite scale, and because it's scale invariant, that's the thing that you want to be focusing on. I'm not sure I'm answering your question in a really good way, but let me think.
Is it because, like, I don't know, is it more like we're kind of getting rid of information but trying to keep the whole picture somewhat equivalent? Whereas if you were, like, zooming in, you'd have to be adding information that was just never there?
Well, again, the goal is that we're interested in like the large distance behavior of any kind of a system, whether it's a spin system or a percolation system. And the point is that by integrating out small scale degrees of freedom, one in some sense is simplifying the system because you're throwing away degrees of freedom and trying to keep only what's important. And so that's, I think, the reason why I'd say you have to zoom in rather than be zooming out. Okay, anyways, so now let's suppose that I choose a scaling factor, which could be 2 or 3 or whatever. So in general, there's a rescale factor B. And so this is the point, this is the one fact that I forgot to mention in yesterday's lecture. And oh, by the way, before I actually do that, let me go back here for a second. So the point, another feature here is that in percolation, there's certain critical observables. There's the correlation length, C of P, which scaled as P minus PC to the minus nu. So this is the characteristic length scale of clusters, finite clusters in percolation. In the spin system, there's the same thing. There's the magnetic correlation length, which is how far do magnetic correlations spread. And this also scales as T minus TC to the power minus nu. There is also here the percolation probability, capital P of little p. What is the probability that a particular site or a particular bond and bond percolation is part of the infinite cluster? And this thing scales as P minus PC to the power beta. Whereas in the magnetic system, the order parameter is the magnetization as a function of temperature, which scales as TC minus T to the power beta. And you know, the goal of critical phenomena is to calculate critical exponents like this. And also we saw here there was the magnetic susceptibility, chi of T, which scaled as T minus TC to the power minus gamma. So these exponents, beta, gamma, nu, are characteristic of phase transitions. And you know, depending on your perspective, it was a triumph of the modern theory of critical phenomena to be able to calculate these critical exponents. You know, one could say, like, why focus so much on critical phenomena only? Because there's the entire phase diagram. But because it has scale invariant behavior, it's something that was really cool and developed, you know, new techniques to understand this thing. The analog of the susceptibility over here is the mean square cluster size. So let me write this as S squared. So you might say, I just said mean cluster size. Why do I write a square here? That'll become clear. You know, I'll say something about that momentarily. But this thing also goes as P minus PC to the power minus gamma. So there's the same kind of observables in both percolation and in a magnetic system or in a spin system. And the goal, again, is to calculate the critical exponents. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you the simplest way that I know of to calculate the critical exponent nu. And by the way, so what the heck is happening here? And what's happening here is that the point is that, so this is a bit of an aside, is if I look at the average cluster size, so this is equal to summation over all cluster sizes S, the number of clusters of size S. And if you just think, like, what does this mean? If I have a cluster of size 1 times the number of clusters of size 1, the size of a cluster of size 2 times the number of clusters of size 2. If you add this all up, this is nothing more than the total probability that a site is occupied or a bond is occupied. So this thing is actually a constant in percolation. And that's why the mean square cluster size is actually the appropriate measure, or the S squared is the appropriate measure of the cluster size. Okay, anyways, let me come now to the...
I didn't understand. Why is this constant?
Okay.
Why is this constant?
Well, so, you know, here's where I'd say, why not actually, like, draw a little picture? So suppose you have, like, some, say, one-dimensional lattice, and you have, you know, you can just, let's say we have only 3 sites. So the possibilities are that, you know, 1 site is occupied, or 2 sites are occupied, or all 3 sites are occupied. And if you just count S, N, S for the system, you'll find that what you're going to get, you know, and this is like with probability P times 1 minus P squared. So if you then do this counting, you'll end up getting just p. So just do the exercise for yourself, because you'll see that it's just equal to a constant.
What's ns here? Is that?
This is the number of clusters of size s, and s is the size of the cluster. So this would be the natural measure of an average size. But it turns out that in the case of percolation, this just adds up to the total probability of a site being occupied. So as an, you know, exercise, just do it for yourself to, before you, like, you know, ask me again. Just do this exercise of three sites where each site is occupied with probability p or empty with probability 1 minus p. Do this calculation and see what comes out. Okay. So anyways, let me get to what I wanted to focus on, which is, suppose now I rescale factor as b. And let me now just do this for the case of percolation. So if there's a rescale factor b, that means that c, after the rescaling, actually, let me write it this way. There will be a new value of p after the rescaling is equal to c before the rescaling divided by b. That is the, that is sort of the fundamental equation. So if I rescale, I, you know, squish by factor of b, the new correlation length is smaller by factor of b.
Wait, sorry, Sid, I'm a little confused by the, like, okay. So the sum of s times ns, so are we taking into account, like, all
configurations?
All three configurations.
Well, there's actually more than three configurations, because there's eight configurations. It's what?
Matters?
No, it doesn't. Order doesn't matter, but you know, each site is either occupied or empty. So there's going to be two states for this site, two for this site, two for that. There's eight possible states. Sum up over all eight states. You know, don't do it now, because you know you're going to not listen to what I ever else I'm going to say. Just do it after the fact, and you'll see that when you do the summation, you'll get just p.
When you say the cluster size, like, would that be? So say you have cluster of just one.
Yes. So that's the
occupied one. So you wouldn't say like.
Right. So this configuration would have a one. There's one cluster of size one. You know, this case would have one cluster of size two. This has one cluster of size three. And, you know, with the different probabilities, and you have to count the number of ways. This happens three ways. This happens three ways. This happens one way. Just do the calculation, and you'll see what comes out. Okay. Anyway. So if we rescale by fact, we have this. Now, it turns out that the relevant parameter is not necessarily, you know, since we're interested close to the critical point, let me write my correlation length, because we see over here the correlation length was not a function of p by itself, but naturally a function of p minus pc. So let me call that p difference delta p. So I'll write c as a function of delta p, delta p. Okay, so I'm saying that C scaling as delta P to the minus nu, and C prime, the new correlation length after rescaling, is going to be scales as delta P prime to the minus nu. So after rescaling, my p changes, because, you know, we saw that when I start rescaling, the value of p changes. It's only at the fixed point that the value of p doesn't change. But now what I'm going to do is just put these two equations together. So here I have, and so now let me go to the limit where delta p is infinitesimally small, so I'll write a differential. So I'll write dp prime by dp. So I just divide this equation by that equation. So that's dp prime dp to the minus nu is equal to c over c prime. And this is equal to, but c over c prime is b. Is this upside down or is this right side up? Dp prime by dp to the minus nu is c over c prime, and c over c prime is b. Okay, so that's the crucial equation. So dp prime by dp is equal to b to the minus 1 over nu power.
Z prime is in the numerator, I think.
Did I get it upside down?
I think so.
Okay, let me try again. This is where dyslexia kills me. Dp prime over p, c over c, yeah?
Prime over c.
Or minus nu should be nu.
Oh, yeah, shape, yes.
Somebody help me here. What have I done wrong?
Where he's pointing, I think.
C over C prime is the unprimed over prime.
Yeah, it is unprimed over prime.
Minus nu. The minus nu.
What?
You should just invert the prime and the unprimed.
I should do this?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, fine. And C prime over C.
Not that one. Not that one.
C over C prime is B.
Yeah, but it's not equal to dp prime dp. It's equal to dp dp prime.
Or dp prime dp to the nu rather yeah. than to
the... Sorry. Okay. So this is correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I can't see it. I just don't get it. But let's. I know this is correct. Okay. So notice that if I know how p changes under rescaling, I calculate a critical exponent. So this is the renormalization group equation that allows one to calculate a critical exponent. And this was the thing which I kind of skipped over last time. So this is our, you know, RG recursion relation. Well, RG relation to calculate a critical exponent. In this case, the critical exponent nu. So what I did last time is that I again try to implement the simplest possible renormalization scheme I could for percolation. And so for percolation, our renormalization was based on the case of bond percolation, where bonds are either occupied or empty with probability p, and when I have like a cluster of bonds that touch at a vertex, that's considered a connected cluster. Yes?
Sorry. I'm a little confused. So there, our nu is related to p minus pc. How do we see... Oh, wait, never mind. Oh, never mind. Got it.
Okay. Yes.
Another question. Is this B an element of the renormalization?
So B is the rescaling factor, which you as a user are free to choose. And so in the case of my slides from last time, I chose B equals 2. And that's kind of the natural case that everyone does. But you could choose B to be anything.
Okay. So what exactly are the elements of the renormalization?
Well, it's not like a Lie group or like a group that you have in mathematics. You say there's elements of a group, there's an inverse, and a unit element, all that. So the word group is a little bit maybe of a misnomer. So don't think about like group as group theory.
Okay.
Yeah. So in percolation, the example that I had of a renormalization group transformation is I said, let's consider the following 2x2 cell, which consists of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 8 bonds. And so this object will tile the entire square lattice with no duplication of any kind, and we're going to renormalize this to just a single bond like this. Whereas in a magnetic system or a spin system, you know, the natural kind of renormalization you might say is that you have like a bunch of spins, or like say a group of 4 spins, which are coupled by some interaction strength J, and this is part of a larger square lattice, and you renormalize this to a single superspin with now interactions J prime among neighboring supersites. And here we'd have a P prime for the renormalized bond compared to a P for the original bond. And the problem with the spin system, which also I can't even see it, is the fact that this transformation is much harder to actually work out. And so I don't want to spend any time on this because, you know, again, it's just a calculation, and it gets a little bit more technically complicated. But suffice it to say that there is physical mechanisms whereby one tries to generate a renormalization group transformation from one scale to another scale by integrating out local degrees of freedom. You sum out all the spin degrees of freedom here to get an effective renormalized spin with an effective renormalized coupling. It turns out that in most of these renormalization group schemes in real space, if you started with near neighbor interactions, you generate further neighbor interactions among the diagonals. So there'll be a J double prime and even further neighbor interactions. And so, so you have to enlarge your space of Hamiltonians and not start with nearest neighbor Hamiltonians, but start with a spatial dependence, a distance dependent Hamiltonian that you have to renormalize all the coupling schemes. It gets very hairy very quickly, or one goes to the momentum space renormalization group. The point is that all of these calculations are technically either very ad hoc and not easy to justify, or very technically complicated. And that's why I want to focus on the case of percolation, because here the calculation is simple and direct, and it doesn't involve so many assumptions or ad hoc features to it. Yeah.
Would you mind re-explaining one more time those two diagrams in the spin system?
You mean from here to here and here to here?
Mostly the latter. But
okay. Yeah. So again, the point is that in a renormalization group approach, you are trying to look at how can you recast a system after rescaling in terms of the original system. So, you know, if I have a large square lattice, for example, and at each side of the square lattice there's a spin, and I want to do some kind of renormalization where I'm going to group, say, four spins and make it into an effective renormalized spin. And so here's my effective renormalized spin. And there was some coupling between the spins here that has to now go to a renormalized coupling. And so one has to develop some kind of a procedure to compute the new coupling in terms of the old coupling. And unfortunately, this technique is just much more difficult to do than a percolation. That's why I want to just finesse all this, because the point is that if you see the example, one example, they're all the same. It's just that this is the absolute simplest example, so why not see the simplest example, and then you can worry about more complicated examples later. Anyways, so coming back to this example, so I would just argue that if I want to say that I want to ask, what is the probability that the renormalized bond is present? So here's a very simple physical criterion. I just look at all realizations of this object such that I get from the left side to the right side. And I just enumerate all possibilities that get me from the left side to the right side. And so if we enumerate those possibilities, we'll have a renormalization. So the number of configurations that, so let's call it the percolating configurations. So first of all, the vertical bonds don't matter for percolating horizontally, so they can be present or not present. And if I sum up present or not present, that happens with either probability p or 1 minus p adds up to 1. So it's not going to affect the equation for the renormalization. So let's just forget about the vertical bonds and only look at horizontal bonds. And then we found last time, or I wrote last time, the configurations that would percolate horizontally. So there was this, there was things like this, and there's four places where this bond could be absent. There is this. So there's a total of five configurations that consist of 1, 2, 3, 4 bonds, one configuration of 5 bonds. Then there's configurations of only 3 bonds. And so there's this guy, the T, and it can be flipped. There's this, which can be flipped. There is this, which can be flipped 4 ways. So there's this is 4 bonds. This is 5 bonds. This is 3 bonds. And then with 2 bonds, you just have this, and there's only, so there's 2 configurations. Configurations. And here for 3, so there's 4 of these guys, 2 of these guys, 2 of these guys. So there's 8 of these guys. There's 5 of these guys and 1 of this guy. So here in this particular case, the relation that relates P prime to P is, I say that, well, The bond is present in the renormalized lattice if there's a percolating configuration in the original lattice in the horizontal direction. And so this gives me then a renormalization group transformation. P prime is equal to P to the 5 plus 5P4 1 minus P plus 8P3 1 minus P squared plus 2P squared 1 minus P cubed.
Is the reason we're only considering like these guys, is it because if we're percolating horizontally, that means we're like smooshing it down horizontally and we only want to keep ones that are like...
Yeah, I mean, there's no squishing going on. I'm just saying, let me compute all possible paths that get me from the left side to the right side. And independently, we can have the percolation in the vertical direction, but it's going to be the same thing as percolating horizontally. But there's no squishing going on.
Does that mean like we're throwing out some vertical degrees of freedom? And
well, the thing is that whether I include them or not doesn't affect the transformation. Because if I can get across this, I mean, if a bond is present here or not present here, that doesn't affect going across from here to here. And if I want to go from this side, you know, like I'm in New York and, you know, the avenues are going this way, the streets are going that way. I want to get like from, you know, 3rd Avenue to 5th Avenue. But, you know, if I go north on 5th Avenue, that doesn't help me going to 3rd Avenue.
How come we include the... Oh, we don't include the top ones because they're not connected to any more horizontal ones, so they don't take us any more horizontally.
Okay, so you know now you've touched on a very good point. So let me come back to that issue like just in a moment. Let me finish the story, and then I'll mention something about just exactly that. So anyways, the point is that here is our renormalization group transformation. And now to calculate the critical exponent, I just go to my renormalization equation, which says that dp prime dp is equal to b. And this relation should be evaluated at the critical point because that's the place that we're interested in. So if I compute dp prime dp, well, first of all, this thing has a fixed point at p prime. So when does p prime equal p? That'll be the fixed point of this transformation. That will define the critical point of the system. This fixed point is at p prime equals, amazingly, 1/2. You can work it out for yourself. 12. Yeah, see, so this is all p to the 5th. I mean, at 1/2, p and 1 minus p are the same. So these are all 1/32nd. And there's 2, 10, 16, 32nd. So at 1/2, this is a fixed point. So that's point number one. And second point is dp prime dp. At p star, we usually use the notation star to denote the fixed point, at the fixed point 1/2. So this I don't expect you to do in your head, but it's a simple calculation. And it turns out it's equal to 13 on 8. And now from our handy dandy renormalization group equation, then nu, the critical point exponent nu, is equal to, log. Yeah, so it's log b divided by log dp prime by dp at the fixed point. And if you work this out, it turns out to be like approximately equal to 1.43. And so voila, we have a critical exponent from a very simple renormalization transformation. And it turns out that in two dimensions, the correct value of the critical exponent is 4/3. And it turns out to be exact for very sophisticated reasons. But at least you see that with an extremely crude approximation, we can calculate a critical exponent to some reasonable degree of accuracy.
How do we find B?
No, but that was the definition here. This was a rescale factor, B equals 2, because I squished by a factor of 2. So that was what the user, you are free to choose. So for example, and this is going to also address the other question, which is that you could have said, well, why did it choose B equals 2? Because yes, maybe I could have gotten across this away if I went up here and joined something here and went around here. There's actually longer range correlations that I've not included in this. And so you might say, maybe to be more accurate to look at a 3x3 cell and do a B equals 3 transformation, it would be more complicated and it actually get closer to the right answer. And so there's all kinds of schemes to try and make the renormalization group more accurate. In the case of percolation, one can do larger cells. In the case of magnetic system, you group more spins together. These become increasingly more complicated as you try and do this. And it turns out that sometimes it does better, and sometimes it does worse. And this is like one of these features of many body systems, that sometimes when you try too hard, it doesn't help you. So you have to be careful about that. Yes?
I have a general confusion about every time you say renormalization group, like what exactly you're referring to here.
So what I'm referring to is the change in parameters, like either the P or the coupling constant as a function of length scale. So remember like when I had like my zoom in picture and you saw that as I was started above PC that somehow the picture got more homogeneous and more blue, which was basically the occupation probability was renormalizing to P equals one. So renormalization transformation refers to how coupling parameters in the model will change under the action of a length rescaling.
It seems very abstract, like, oh, this is generally how they change. Like, is there a physical, like a concrete way to think about it, for example, in this like percolation picture, to think about exactly what the RG group refers, or the RG group refers
to? So again, what I would argue the renormalization group is doing is that it's saying, I start with a value P at the initial scale, I squished down and I found an effective value P prime at the next scale. And you know, here we actually did a specific calculation. And I continue doing this ad infinitum. So P will continue to renormalize ad infinitum, either renormalize to P equals zero or P equals one. But the interesting case is when we're sitting right at exactly the critical point where P does not change. And then the, let's call the eigenvalue of the renormalization group transformation, this number here, turns out to be equal to a critical exponent. So that's the magic of this, that, you know, this very simple set of equations. I have C is rescaled. C depends on the parameter dp in a particular way. And by putting these two equations together, we have a relation between an exponent and the rescale factor and how much p changes at each iteration of the renormalization. Does that help?
As the transformation that's happening that allows us to find this fixed.
Yes. Yeah, ask away.
Critical exponents here, they're not like a universal characteristic of the physical system. They depend on the rescaling factor somehow. Like,
well, so yeah, but again, the thing is that this renormalization group is a completely ad hoc calculational scheme. And so if I change B, yes, it seems that for a different B rescale factor, I'd get a different critical point exponent. But the issue is that if I go to a more sophisticated realization of the renormalization group, one sees that, in fact, it should not depend on B. So, I mean, here in this very ad hoc approach, yes, it looks like it depends on B. But when you do, say, the momentum space renormalization group, the exponents do not depend on the rescale factor. But all real space renormalizations will all have B-dependent exponents. And that's just an artifact of like the approximation that's involved.
Does it mean that rescaling factor B here actually plays a physical role in our term?
No, it doesn't. It's you know, again, we are free as you know, the user to choose our rescale factor anything we want. And typically one chooses rescale factor B because it's the simplest rescale factor to do the calculation. You see that if I was going to rescale from 3 to 1, I'd have to sum up many more degrees of freedom. Be much more complicated. And so almost all real space renormalization schemes use a rescale factor of 2. I see lots of questions, so I'll get to all of them, but you had one first.
Oh, yeah. I think there can be an oscillating solution, which means like,
oscillating?
Yeah. Like if you do like, the first renormalization, it doesn't change the value, but after that, kind of, if you change, then in that case, if we change the scale to the P to the 4,
right?
Then it becomes a fixed point.
But I don't. What do you mean by oscillation? That I don't understand.
So, like, if you do the renormalization first,
yeah,
then you change the values,
right?
Then again, we do it. Then it just comes back to the initial value. Then it seems like.
Well, no, but I guess I would disagree in the sense that if I'm doing some kind of a, if I'm taking a simple homogeneous system. and applying renormalization to it. Under rescaling, if like the temperature or the P in this case changes in a certain direction, if I rescale another time, the P and the temperature have to change in the same direction after a second transformation. There's no other possibility for a homogeneous system. So more questions? Yes.
Can you explain again why the fixed point is where you are evaluating?
Why it is?
Why the fixed point at P equals to half is when you are where you are evaluating your derivative?
P prime equals P.
Yeah, so the you know, again, if we just come back to here, I mean, we're interested close to the critical point. So, you know, we want to evaluate this when both P prime, delta P prime and delta P are infinitesimally small, which means at the critical point. There was more questions.
Oh, so if you like come up with this particular renormalization transformation for percolation for like each B in succession,
right?
If you get higher and higher Bs, do the critical exponents that you calculate converge?
Yes.
To the right ones necessarily?
Well, you know, again, I don't think a mathematician has proved this point, but like from a physical perspective, if I were to do more and more, you know, larger rescaling factors and including more degrees of freedom inside of the cell, that becomes essentially doing the exact calculation. So it becomes better. And so, in fact, this was done in the late 70s by a group at BU that actually did this large cell position space normalization group and showed that it got more and more accurate as you made larger cell sizes.
Doesn't it like when you're changing the rescaling factor, the possible configurations are changing, that somehow change the
exponent
stays the same or what?
Yeah, as you increase the number of degrees of freedom, it's like you're sort of summing up over, you're doing like a more accurate calculation because you're calculating, okay, all I can just say is that if you were to do B equals infinity, that would be like doing the exact calculation. You're evaluating every single configuration. But, you know, for finite B, you're throwing some things away, and you throw away less as B gets larger. Yes?
I still don't understand the... so if you do the rescaling again, when this P prime,
right,
and you say B is equal to 2,
right,
do you get the same configuration again?
Yeah, so the only thing is that now if you say, well, this is my P prime, now I sort of do the same thing once again.
Then
I'm going to compute a P double prime after doing another rescaling by factor of B equals 2. And I just do this over and over again. So I go from P to P prime to P double prime, dot, 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 dot. And again, if P is less than PC, I renormalize to 0. If P is larger than PC, I renormalize to 1. But at PC, at the critical point, this renormalization will stay invariant. And the behavior of this transformation at this fixed point is what determines the critical point exponent.
If you do this again, what numbers do you get here exactly?
Well, no, so the point is that at the fixed point, it's the same thing if I renormalize a second time.
Again, 13 over 8, and you get the new equal to...
Yeah, 14. Yeah, because the thing is that if I renormalize a second time and go from P prime to...
Oh, right.
You know, P double prime, the relation between P double prime and P prime is exactly the same. Everything is the same. So at the fixed point, everything is invariant. So again, this renormalization approach is like, if you've not been exposed to it, it can seem very bizarre because it's not, you know, it's effectively trying to treat many degrees of freedom in a very unusual way by looking at invariance principles. And so it's unlike anything you've ever been exposed to, like in an elementary physics course, like classical mechanics or electromagnetism. You're looking at like the movement of a single particle or movement of a single charge. Here it's like all degrees of freedom together. Yes.
This formula, if you evaluate it in any other P that is not P star, still gives the same answer, the constant answer. But I don't think you can use this formula because you assume the power law.
Yes.
Where you said, I think you said for P equal to PC, we only have a power law.
That's right. Only at
so,
PC.
So this mechanism in this black board right here, it doesn't work for any other P.
That's right. It's only at PC that you have.
So this P prime is just for P equal to PC. So we don't.
No. But the thing is that this relation P is a function of P prime is a function of P that holds for any value of P. If I were to plot this function, here is P, here is P prime, and it goes between 0 and 1. So here is 1 and 1. Here is, say, the 45 degree line. This function, if you plot it out, looks something like this, with a fixed point at 1/2.
And what I meant was the dp prime dp, and then we calculate that and say the logarithm of b over the logarithm dp prime dp, that only evaluated p equal to pc gives you a meaningful.
That's correct. Absolutely. Yes.
I'm sorry. I feel like it's a dumb question because I keep asking it, but I don't really understand what it means to percolate horizontally. Like, what is, like, percolation, does that mean going from one site to the other?
Going from one side to the other side.
And
so, again, like, if I think of this as New York City, so here's 3rd Avenue, 4th Avenue, and 5th Avenue. You're here on 3rd Avenue, and you want to get to 5th Avenue by going either on 42nd Street or 43rd Street.
So you're picking all the configurations that have some connection from one side to the
other. Exactly.
Even if they have, like, disconnected connection that's just there.
Well, what is a disconnected connection?
So like there you have like two sites going like the
here.
Yeah, that one.
This one here.
Two sites going there and then one site that's
yeah, so let me make this look a little bit more precise. This is something that looks like this and like this and like this.
Help you go
from no, but this, the, this, but this help got you across.
Yeah.
So if you did, this doesn't matter. But it's just that we want to sum up over all possible configurations that get you from 3rd Avenue to 5th Avenue. This is one such configuration.
Why are we specifically looking at the configurations that get you from one side to the other?
So this is the physical meaning of this renormalization transformation, which is we have to come up with the criterion. How do we compute P prime given P? And so I'm arguing that if I can get across horizontally in my renormalized cell, that corresponds to getting across horizontally in the original cell. Go ahead.
So it's like the probability of like actually having that connection. So eventually we can calculate like the probability that you have some form of an infinite chain.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're summing over all configurations, even though some of them might not help you.
Right.
Why are you discarding some of the vertical ones? We could just put them there and say this is another configuration, but we don't need it.
That's right. But the point is that, you know, like if there's a bond which, like this one, that doesn't affect anything, but then there's a configuration with this bond present and another configuration with the bond absent. And if you sum up over those configurations, there'll be one term that have a 1 minus p and another one has a term p. I add them up, I get 1. So that's why I'm not worrying about the vertical bonds. More questions? We go all day on this? Whoa.
Oh, that happens all the time.
Was this? Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, don't lean on this. Don't lean on this. Okay, I'll try and remember that. Okay, so I guess that is all I want to say about renormalization. So it's kind of a whirlwind tour. In like sort of less than one of the order of one lecture, I've told you all I think that's important to think about physically about what is a renormalization group. Everything else is like much more complicated calculation, but I hope that at least you get some sense of the principle behind it, which is that you have a system that's near a critical point, you apply the rescaling, one has a change in like the parameters of the system, the rescaled system, and you try and relate the parameters of the rescaled system to the original system, and that relationship is called a renormalization transformation, and from that it is possible to calculate critical exponents. Yes.
How would this apply to like renormalization and quantum field theory, because what's the critical point,
the point is that renormalization, as I've mentioned here, it applies for any kind of a system at the critical point. So for a magnetic system, you would take like a group of spins, you sum up, you sum out or sum over internal degrees of freedom of the cell to get a renormalized spin and try and figure out what is a coupling constant between renormalized spins. And so the same thing would happen in any kind of a many-body system where one is at the critical point. You just sum up small-scale degrees of freedom to get like an effective Hamiltonian of a larger, of a rescaled system, and the rescaling transformation from that you can extract critical exponents. So this happens in all types of systems. It's just that I argue that this is like the absolute simplest realization of where you can do an explicit calculation.
Sorry for all the questions.
No, it's all fine.
In quantum field theory, what would it mean to be at a critical point?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a quantum field theorist, so you have to ask Francois that.
We kind of take it for granted because usually we like integrate from like all scales, and so we assume all scales are present.
Yeah, well, when you're at a critical point, all scales are present.
In this case, yes, but in quantum field theory, aren't we like always integrating from like minus infinity to infinity or something?
Well, you know, I don't want to like stick my foot into quantum field theory because I'll, okay. Yeah, so let me not say anything about that.
Okay.
Anything else?
If your nu was one.
Yes.
Would that mean, what if, it seems like it's kind of has to have a significant meaning, because you're because then your xi over xi prime would be.
If nu is one, that would say that dp prime dp would happen to coincide with b.
Yeah, what is that?
So that would mean that in this particular case, it'd be equal to two. No, there's no particular meaning to nu equals one. I mean, it's just.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that would just correspond to the slope. Instead of being 13/8, it'd be equal to 2.
How can dp prime equal to 2? Like, it's probably...
No, it's a derivative, dp prime dp.
Okay.
This derivative, I mean, this could be very steep as you increase. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, this is a breaking point. This is really a breaking point because this is lecture number 5, is that correct? Yeah. And so there's 15 lectures here, and this sort of is the end of equilibrium statistical physics. And so now we're going to switch gears completely and talk about non-equilibrium statistical physics. And it's very different than equilibrium. In equilibrium, there is a principle, minimizing the free energy or maximizing the entropy, from which one can derive everything. But in non-equilibrium statistical physics, there is no such general principle. And so, you know, the field is very different in its character because it doesn't have, it's more ad hoc and just like trying to develop techniques to solve non-equilibrium processes. So this is the end of equilibrium. So now we're going to go to non-equilibrium statistical physics. Well, let me get rid of this because this looks equilibrium-like. So, you know, in the space of the next 2.5 weeks, I can't really do too much justice to the whole field, but I want to just kind of outline some topics that I think are really crucial for understanding both the ideas underlying non-equilibrium statistical physics and some of the basic techniques. So, let me begin with the master equation. And the word master equation actually came as a joke. So there's a very famous statistical physicist in the 40s, 50s, and 60s named George Uhlenbeck. And he said, you know, I have this way of describing a non-equilibrium system. Here is my equation. And, you know, some wag in the audience said, what kind of equation is it? He said, well, it's the master equation because it describes everything. So that's how it came out to be that this happened. And the idea behind the master equation is the following, which is like, let's imagine a arbitrary state space where we have discrete states. So this is you know, a microscopic state, a microstate. And in equilibrium statistical physics, if I were to order my states as a function of energy, then we know that low energy things would be highly likely to be occupied. High energy states would be less likely to be occupied. The probability of being occupied is proportional to E to the minus beta, the energy. And so we have that principle. But if we don't have that principle, then the only thing, well, so first of all, so in equilibrium statistical physics, we have this notion that there's this Boltzmann factor. But it doesn't tell us how this Boltzmann factor is achieved. If I prepare a system, say with all the occupancy, all like in the ground state, it's got to go to the Boltzmann state. How do we get to that Boltzmann state? Or if I prepare it like every site is equally likely occupied, how do I go to the Boltzmann state? And so the way that one does this is by something called the master equation. So let me call each site here I, and there'll be a corresponding P sub I, the probability that site I is occupied. And what I'm interested in is how this probability of being at each site changes as a function of time. And there's two types of terms that characterize this. There is a summation over all neighbor sites j, w, j going to I. So this is the rate at which you go from site j to site I. And you sum up over all neighbors j that are neighbors of I, pj. So if here I'm at site I, then how can I get to site I a little bit later on in time if I'm at some neighboring site j? And if there is a transition rate from j to I, then the probability of being at site I will increase because there's a rate of leaking from j to I, and that leakage rate is the rate at which you leak times the probability that you're already here, because that's going to be the current that goes from j to I. So this is the inflow. And then there's a corresponding term for outflow, summation over neighboring sites j, w I going to j. So if I'm sitting at site I, then I have leakage to all neighboring sites, and the leakage will correspond to a loss of probability at site I. And so this leakage rate is wij. And then if I multiply by pi, which is the probability that I'm at I, this will give me the total current flowing out of site I. So this is the total outflow. So this is what's called the master equation. And from this, once you specify the transition rates, then one can specify the dynamics of the system. And so just one second. And so as we're going to learn in a few examples where I specify the rates, then we can look at the dynamics of the system. In non-equilibrium statistical physics, there's a lot of effort in trying to infer what are the rates from the probabilities, which is another sort of, it's like an inference problem that's very different than what I'm going to be focusing on, which is basically a more, I say, blue-collar solve problem, which is just given rates, just solve for the probabilities. Yes, you had a question.
When you say neighboring sites, is that just the expression, or?
Well, so neighboring sites here is not really well defined. What I mean is like, if any site is, if there's a transition rate from any site, j going to I, then it's a neighbor. So just as long as, you know, whoever has a non-zero transition rate, there is a, okay. So let me just say a few words about this. First of all, this is a first order equation in time, which means that time reversal symmetry is broken. Broken. So that's one important point, no time reversal symmetry. Another point is that if you have an isolated system, so if I have a bunch of points and it's in equilibrium, so equilibrium means that dpi by dt is equal to zero. Yes, question.
Sorry, how come time reversal symmetry is broken? Like, if you just went back in time, wouldn't inflow just switch with outflow pretty much?
You know what? I think I'm going to get to it today. If you can wait like about 15 minutes, I think I'm going to give you a specific example to show you that can't happen.
Okay.
But, you know, keep it in mind, and if it's not answered in 15 minutes, then jump up again.
Okay,
so equilibrium means that the probabilities aren't changing, because that's the definition of equilibrium, that the system is time independent. But what does this imply? This implies that the total inflow, oh, I guess this is in the way now, right? Tell me when I can't go any lower. Total inflow equals total outflow at each site. And what this means then is summation over, I guess I'm going to raise this a bit. Summation over all j, w, j going to I, p, j. So that's the total current that starts at all the neighboring sites j and comes to I. So that's the total inflow has to equal the total outflow, which is the rate flowing from site I to all the neighbors that it's connected to times the probability of being at site I. So this would be the total current that's flowing out. Gesundheit. The next thing, though, is that there's another principle that comes out of nowhere. It's called detail balance principle. And it turns out this is one of the more useful constructs of non-equilibrium statistical physics, which is that this criterion for equilibrium is actually so vague that it's not terribly useful to actually apply it. And so I don't know who invented the detail balance condition, but the detail balance condition says that instead of insisting that the total inflow equals the total outflow, you insist that the total current across every single bond is equal. So detail balance is that W, I, J, P, J for 1J and 1I is equal to W, J going to I, P, I. I'm sorry, PI. So that's a detail balance condition. So it's much more stringent than the total outflow equals total inflow, because it's saying that across every single bond, there's no net current. And that's sort of the definition that we typically use in non-equilibrium statistical physics examples.
I think the I's and J's are like...
Did I have a...
IPI is not.
Just hang on a second. Sorry. Let me just go back here. Yeah. So I mixed up I and J here. So again, this is WJIPJ. So this is the rate of going from J to I times probably being at a neighboring site. So this is the total current coming from all neighboring sites from a site J to site I. Yeah, okay, so I just copied this backwards. And this is WI going to J, EI. Okay, thank you.
Why are we assuming that at any time the probability is exactly the same? So previous steps don't have any...
Well, no, but I'm talking about in equilibrium. Then the system has to be in equilibrium, which means it's time independent.
The formula that we had, dpi dt.
Okay.
Why is that not dependent on previous steps? It's just always.
Well, because, okay, so this is also defines a Markov process in that there's no memory. So I'm assuming here that your transition rate from here to here doesn't depend on like where you came from or how long you've been sitting here. There's no memory built into the system.
Is this going back to the percolation thing?
No, this has nothing to do. This has nothing to do with percolation. This is a time-dependent phenomenon. I'm assuming that the rate at which you transition just depends on your transition rate and how much is already there. It doesn't depend on what happened in the past or what happened five steps in the past. So it's a memoryless process. Okay. So now I want to spend the rest of, I guess, today is working out some example to try and illustrate all of this. So let me put this way up here. So let's work out an example just to try and see everything in action here. And here is my simplest example I know of. Well, actually, I think I could think of one example simple. Let's imagine we have three sites, sites 1, 2, and 3, and we put a random walk on this triangle. Say we started here, and it can hop to its nearest neighbors, and the hopping rates, so here would be the hopping rate, W13, the probability of hopping from site 1 to site 3. Here is, you know, W12, and similarly, there's a back rate, W331, etc. And to make life simple, I'm going to choose all these rates to be the same. So all the W's, I'm going to set them all equal to 1. And now I want to compute, what is the probability that a random walk is at a given site at time t, given that I start the system in some initial state? So let's write down the master equations for this process and solve them. So p1 dot, how does this change with time? Well, I could be at 2 and hop to 1, or it could be at 3 and hop to 1. And if the rates are 1, so then this is going to be p2 plus p3. But then if I'm at 1, I can hop to 2, or if I'm at 1, I can hop to 3. So there's two ways of hopping out versus one way of hopping in from each site. This is minus 2p1. Does that make sense? And now to get the rest of the equations, well, you know, we can, you see it's like such a simple system, you could just do by cyclic permutation. So p2 dot is equal to p3 plus p1 minus 2p2. And p3 dot is equal to p1 plus p2 minus 2p3. So this is the master equations that we want to solve. And now the only thing missing in this to actually solve this is we need some initial condition. And let me take, just for the case of simplicity, the initial condition that a particle starts at site 1. So the initial condition, which I'll always write as IC, is that PI at t equals 0 is equal to delta I 0. Okay, so let's solve this. So how do we solve this? Well, here's where, like, my lack of knowledge of what you know and what you don't know might play some role here, which is that how many people have seen Laplace transform? Most people, but not all people. So the point here is that, but how many people have seen Fourier transforms? Everybody. So Laplace transform and Fourier transform are morally the same thing. The only difference is that in the Fourier transforms, you have an infinite space and you decompose into sine waves, and it turns out you can transform differential equations to algebraic equations and solve them. And so the only difference with Laplace transforms is, first of all, it's defined on the half interval, time is only positive. And instead of doing a spectral decomposition into sine waves and cosine waves, you do a spectral decomposition into decaying exponentials. But everything else between Fourier transforms and Laplace transforms are the same. So in order to solve this, what we're going to do is we're going to take these equations, multiply by e to the minus st, and integrate from 0 to infinity all of these equations. And so this is like multiplying with e to the ikx and integrating over all x. But here it's now my variable, or like e to the I omega t and integrating over time. But here we only integrate from positive time. And so now I'm going to define I of s is equal to integral from 0 to infinity pi of t e to the minus st. Now, if those of you have seen Laplace transforms before, oftentimes you see it with a tilde on top to distinguish that this is the Laplace transform, this is the function in real time. And I'm a person who really believes in minimalism. And so I hate writing this tilde because, like, in LaTeX, you've got to put the wide tilde, you know, over everything, and I just hate that. So I'm going to stop writing the tilde, but the fact that there's an argument here, or by context, will be clear whether I'm talking about the transform function or the original function. So the thing is that if I do this integration here, this is p2 of s, this is p3 of s, this is p2 minus 2p1 of s. Similarly here, everything is, you know, on the right-hand side, it's just Laplace transforms, but now we have p2 dot. And so what is p2 dot e to the minus st integral? And what you do here, and for those of you who've not seen Laplace transforms, I'll just do this one little trick here. So if I look at, say, p2 dot e to the minus st integral from 0 to infinity dt, dt, so what you can do here is do integration by parts. You can then change the differentiation from this guy to this guy. And this is equal to p2 at t equals 0. I'm sorry, p2 e to the minus st from 0 to infinity. And then I have plus p2 s e to the minus st dt. And at t equals infinity, the exponential zero, at t equals zero, if the particle does not start at site two, then this is zero, so this goes away. And so I just have s times the Laplace transform again. So the only...
the initial condition again, I don't understand p, the notation.
So this just says that p, the probability being at site I, t equals zero, is this Kronecker delta. And this is, the Kronecker delta is zero if I is equal to, delta I 1. So if you start, so this means that it's 1 at site 1 and 0 everywhere else. Thank you for keeping me honest. Okay. Anyway, so if I do all of this stuff here, what's going to happen is that here I'm going to have SP1 minus the initial condition. So, sorry. So let me do one more thing here. This is equal to 0 minus P2 of T equals 0 plus SP2 of S. So at t equals 0, p2 is 0 by definition, so this went away. But for p1, I'll get minus the initial condition, which was 1. So my equations turn into s minus 1. SP1 minus 1 is equal to p2 plus p3 minus 2p1. P2 times S is equal to P3 plus P1 minus 2P2. And finally, SP3 is equal to P1 plus P2 minus 2P3. So we've converted our coupled set of differential equations into a coupled set of algebraic equations, which is exactly what happened if you were like doing a problem where you use Fourier transform. You have, like, say, a set of differential equations, you Fourier transform, they become algebraic equations, you solve them, and then you have to invert the transformation to get everything as a function of real time. Anyways, so we have three equations coupled together, and so let me just tell you what the solution is, because it's just easier to just write the solution than to try and puzzle it out. And what you're going to find is that P2 equals P3 is equal to 1 over 3 SS plus 3. And P1 I forget. One S plus one equal to S plus one over three S plus three. And now we have to invert these Laplace transforms to compute what is everything as a function of time. And it turns out that in this particular case, these are fairly simple because you can do what's called a partial fraction decomposition. This is equal to one over three S minus 1 over s plus 3, I guess, let's see, s, 3s, 3. And this, there'll be a similar decomposition. But the point is that, and again, for those of you who've not seen Laplace transforms, I mean, all I'm doing is like you look at the table of inverse Laplace transforms. Or if you've seen them, then hopefully this looks familiar. 1 over 3s has the inverse Laplace transform of constant, 1 third. This has inverse Laplace transform of e to the minus 3t. So this tells me that p1 of t, or I'm sorry, p2 of t equals p3 of t, and that's equal to 1 third, 1 minus e to the minus 3t. And p1 of t turns out to be equal to so it's equal to 2/3 plus 1/3 e to the minus 3t. So that's the solution to this problem. So notice a couple of things about this. So I start in the initial condition at t equals 0. This cancels out, and I just have 1. And as t goes to infinity, everybody goes to 1/3. So it's probably not a surprise that if I have equal hopping rates everywhere and I put a random walk on this three-site triangle and I just let the system, you know, evolve ad infinitum, that each site becomes equally likely occupied. So this is a very simple example, but it's very revealing because it shows already some very important features about Markov processes, which is that in the case where all the hopping rates are the same, the probability of being occupied anywhere is the same. So let me...
Was P1 supposed to be one third?
Say it again?
Was P1 supposed to be one third plus one third to the minus 3t? Because you said that t, when t goes to infinity, all probabilities have to be the same.
Oh, sorry. Crap. One third, two thirds. Thank you. Sorry. Okay. So another way we can represent this is we could think of this as p dot, where p is now a column vector, 1, 2, 3, is equal to a transition matrix w times p. So that's like, you know, conceptually what we're doing here. And so in principle, like, my graph could be anything. It could have been a four-site square. It could have been a million sites. It's just that the w matrix gets larger and larger if I have a more complicated graph. But here, my matrix w has the form 1, -2, 1, 1, 1, -2, 1, 1, 1, -2. That is the form of the W matrix. Where here I'm thinking of P as like the column vector P1, P2, P3.
I think we're missing a one third.
Am I thinking a one third?
Yeah. But I'm P2 equals P3 equals that partial fraction decomposition times like a one third factor out in front of everything.
Isn't that the one third that's out in front here?
Oh, maybe. Does that?
No, that's right. That's right.
Okay.
No, not this.
So let me mention just a few things about this more generally. So first of all, so here, equilibrium. Which is P dot equals zero, which is the same as WP is equal to zero. So if I think about this, this is like an eigenvalue equation with eigenvalue zero. So it says that equilibrium, equilibrium corresponds to eigenvector with eigenvalue zero. So that's how you define the equilibrium state. So if I'm dealing with a much larger state space, if you can find the eigenvalue, the eigenvector with zero eigenvalue, you found the equilibrium state. Another feature to notice here is that notice that all the rows, the entries sum to zero. And so when you're doing like matrix multiplication, if all the rows sum to zero, that tells you that a state where each of the elements in the column vector are the same, when I sum up -2, +1, +1, if these are all the same value, then I'll get zero. So the equilibrium, so that says that equilibrium state, so if, if Wij is all the same, then equiprobable state is the equilibrium state. Equiprobable is equilibrium. And last point, and this is going to answer, I hope, your question, which is that notice that all the rows and columns of this matrix sum to zero. And that fact is enough to tell you that the determinant of W is equal to zero. So that's a fact from matrix algebra. But if the determinant is equal to zero, that tells you that the matrix does not have an inverse. And if it doesn't have an inverse, if there's a transformation, you know, P dot equals WP, you can't go backwards because there's no inverse transformation. So there's this feature that you know, in the stochastic process, you can't undo it. You can't go backwards in time. So this is, you know, this to my mind is like the most simple example I'm aware of, well, actually the simplest example is you just have two sites, but that was like too trivial. But anyways, just a simple example that shows the master equation in action, the natural technique for how you're solving it. So you might think, well, this Laplace transform, you know, how generic is it? And it turns out to be completely generic. In these sorts of problems, you always can solve it using Laplace transforms because that's a natural thing to do when you have first order equations in time. So any questions with this example? Yes.
Is the reason we didn't consider like the ability to jump back to the same site? So let's say you're on site one and you want to stay at site one.
So you would say, let's add another rate here, say W11.
Can we just not consider that for simplicity? Like,
yeah.
If we did consider that.
Well, we could certainly put it in. You know, like if there was a W11 here, there'd be a term on the right-hand side here plus W11P1. And so you get slightly more complicated equations. You could do the same thing. So, you know, you are now free as the user to just check your understanding by just playing around with simple graphs and putting in rates as you like and just seeing, like, how does it change things?
Also, another question is, like, so I can see math. Like if the determinant is zero, there's no inverse transformation. But on a more intuitive level, like what's stopping you from saying, like, if you flip time, you just say W goes from like J to I turns from like I to J, and would it be?
I mean, the thing is that like going in one direction, there's this sort of notion that you're mixing things up. And it's very, you can't unmix it by another stochastic process.
And it's just the fact that it's stochastic.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so certainly, you know, if I take like, you know, a piece of paper and, you know, fold it, and then I can unfold it. But, you know, if I rip it up to shreds, then I can't put it back together again.
And is it just like because we don't have the memory of?
That's right, because this is a memoryless process. The rate at which you hop does not depend on where you came from.
Also, you're saying that if t goes to infinity, you're getting to equilibrium.
Right.
So at any time that you start any sort of process and you let it when t goes to infinity, you get to the equilibrium.
Right. That's right. There's sort of a unidirectionality. There's an arrow of time here.
Just
yes.
A little bit more on Bacha's question. If you have like another kind of process between like P1 itself, like having W11P1, then the determinant of W wouldn't be zero, and you can have the inverse of process. We cannot have inverse of W because W.
Well, no, but the thing is that, but the point here is that if I screwed this up by having like an inhomogeneity. See, right now this is like a very homogeneous system. All the sites are the same, but if I put one rate here for only one of these things, then it's going to work it out for yourself. Just see, like, what is the equilibrium state of this system with an extra hopping rate of just going back to yourself? And then we can have this discussion, like, what happens then? But do this as an exercise.
The intuition was that, like, only the diagonal elements of W are going to change, but equilibrium state would still be P dot equal to zero. Because
you know,
the minus 2 would be, like, minus 2 plus omega by 1.
That's right. That's right. What that tells you then is that but the rows and the rows no longer add up to zero. And so, you know, what the last two statements are no longer holding.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's fine. That means that the equilibrium state is not the equiprobable state.
So.
Yeah. Yes.
At equilibrium, we do have higher results.
Well, but at equilibrium, there's no, you know, nothing depends on time anymore. We're in equilibrium, so you can't tell forwards or backwards because everything is static.
Yeah, but this equation still holds that it's still,
like, yes, but it's going to be, I mean, but the point is that at equilibrium, P dot is equal to zero. So the equation we're going to solve is this equals to zero at equilibrium.
Yeah, but W still does not have the inverse.
That's right. Certainly does not. I mean, W is a fixed matrix. You know, just.
I think what he's asking is, so at equilibrium, it doesn't matter if you have those self.
Right.
Whatever.
Right.
Still, your eigenvalue is zero, and you still.
Yeah, but the point is, but the thing is that the sum of the rows don't add up all to zero, and so it means that your equilibrium state is not the equiprobable state.
But if you have an eigenvalue of zero, isn't that synonymous with saying that W is not invertible?
Yeah.
So even though the sum of all of the entries is not zero, it's still an equilibrium. Your W
okay.
is not invertible.
All right, so. I'm not sure I'm going to have a good answer for you there, so let me punt on that one.
Okay.
I mean, I think that certainly what I've said in the case of a homogeneous system is certainly correct. So listen, I've got about three more minutes, and so I want to spend in the last 3 minutes, I just want to talk about another example. Just I'm going to set the stage, and this is for you to think about. So that was example one. Here's example two. I'm just going to like define it, and then I'm not going to solve anything here. And it's just a good old one-dimensional random walk. So here I have site n, n plus 1, n plus 2, n minus 1, n minus 2, dot, dot, dot. And there'll be a hopping rate to go from nearest neighbors. And let's choose the hopping rate to be 1 for everybody. And so now our basic quantity is pn, the probability of being at site n at time t. And how can this change? Well, if I look at site n, there's a way to hop to n plus 1 and a way out to hop to n minus 1. So there's two ways, a total of two ways out. And there's one way in because it could be at n minus 1 and hop to n, or at n plus 1 and hop to n, and two ways in. One way from n plus 1 and one way from n minus 1. So there's pn minus 1. Minus 2pn plus pn plus 1. So that is the master equation for the one-dimensional continuous time random walk. So again, I emphasize here continuous time because it's not like at each step you make, at each time unit you make exactly one step. There is a leakage rate which is controlled by the total rate of hopping. And so, you know, it's possible that a random walk doesn't move in a time interval dt. But this is telling you in continuous time, how the probability is evolving. So for those of you who know some mathematical physics, this thing is called the discrete second difference. And in the continuous limit, this goes to the second derivative. And then this would just become the diffusion equation, the continuous limit for which we know the solution. But what I'm going to do next time is I'm going to solve this in discrete time using our friend, the Laplace transform, and we'll find what is the probability distribution of this random walk. Now, in order to solve this, we need one more thing, which is the initial condition. And so let me choose the initial condition that Pn at t equals 0 is equal to delta. And now this time it's going to be correct. It's going to have delta n 0, not 1. So that's saying I start with the particle at the origin. And we want to ask, like, what is the probability distribution of this random walk? So it probably doesn't come as a surprise that the probability distribution is a Gaussian, because that's what we know it is. But we want to solve it in the discrete time formulation. And so if you want to try this on your own, let me just tell you what I'm going to do next. Is you're going to take this equation, do integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus st, and solve this in the Laplace domain. And then I'm going to find pn as a function of s in the Laplace domain. And then I'm going to invert it to get pn of t, and we'll get the famous Gaussian probability distribution. So that's what I'm going to do next time. Let me just say one more thing about this, which is that you see when I did the Laplace transform over there, so if any of you want to try this on your own, we got an algebraic equation. And here, if we do the same thing, we're going to get another algebraic equation, which will be like something like spn is pn minus 1 minus 2pn plus pn plus 1. This is what's called a second order difference equation. Because it's like you go from n minus 1 to n to n plus 1, it couples two different values of n. So it's a second order discrete difference equation. And so if I were to tell you, what is the solution to a constant coefficient, because the coefficients in front of the pn's are constant, what is the solution to a constant coefficient second order difference equation? And I assume that most of you would say, I have no idea. But then if I say to you, what is the solution to a constant coefficient second order differential equation, which you had in freshman calculus? What's the solution there? What? What is the solution to a second order constant coefficient differential equation? What? I heard somebody say the right answer. Exponential. Who said that? Okay, brownie points for you. So anyways, exponential. So it turns out that the calculus of differences and the calculuses of differentials are exactly the same. So now I ask you again, what is the solution to a second order constant coefficient difference equation? Exponential. So if you assume an exponential, you can solve this. So I'm just giving you this as a hint, because one is you might want to try it on your own. And the second point is that, as you're going to see, the calculus of difference equations is exactly the same line by line as the calculus of differential equations, but it's just more complicated. And that's, in fact, why Newton invented calculus, because calculus is much simpler than differences. And so, you know, that's sort of a philosophical point, that why calculus is simple is that it makes things like this much easier to deal with. Because to solve this in the continuous limit is just like one or two lines. To solve it discrete, we're going to see next time, we're going to have to do a little bit of work. Okay, so that is it for today. Thank you very much, and I'll see you.